Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we will continue now with the study of the Alagadupama Sutta. This is the discourse on the simile of the snake, number 22 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, and last time we came to paragraph number 26. Here the Buddha has, at this point, the Buddha has gone through and he's declared that he does not see any, in the previous paragraphs, he does not see any possession that is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. He does not see any doctrine of self that, if clung to, would not give rise to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. He does not see any support of views that, if one relies upon it, would not give rise to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Okay, and then in paragraph 25, he establishes that a self and what belongs to a self are not apprehended, and anything belonging to a self are not apprehended as true and established. Okay, now, beginning with paragraph 26, or in paragraph 26, he is going to undertake what is he calls the classic argument for the teaching of anatta. This is the argument in terms of the three characteristics as applied to the five aggregates. We come across this argument in the Samyutta Nikaya, the book on the aggregates, many, many times. So one begins with material form, the rupa khanda. Is it permanent or impermanent? Okay, material form. This is a question that appeals to direct experience, direct observation. Material form is, obviously, it's impermanent. One can see any kind of material object eventually disintegrates, disappears. The rupa, the form of one's own body, is constantly changing, constantly disintegrating. Eventually, the body passes away and disappears and vanishes. Okay, then comes another question. Is what is impermanent dukkha or sukha? Is it suffering or happiness? Okay, this question, it's framed in the same way. It looks like it's an appeal to observation. But here, we're moving from observation to evaluation. That is, we are considering, we're using a particular standpoint in order to evaluate what is impermanent. And we're asking whether anything is impermanent can be taken as a basis true basis or a basis for true happiness. And here the evaluation comes in what we might call the underlying assumption that for when we speak about happiness, what we really mean is a true, stable, we call this invulnerable happiness. That is a happiness that cannot be altered, cannot be corrupted. Because looked at the common sense level, things that are impermanent, you ask any person on the street going shopping at what are the big, when there's a sale at a department store, is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? It is real happiness, otherwise they wouldn't be there when there's at the shopping mall, when there's a big, right after Christmas, even before Christmas, everybody is going shopping to buy Christmas presents to give to their friends and relatives, because the Christmas presents for them is what is happiness. So they don't think whether the Christmas presents are permanent or impermanent. But now we're trying to examine this on a somewhat deeper level from that of common sense or immediate experience, and inquiring, is this going to give us real, stable, lasting happiness? That which is impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. And when we examine this, things that are impermanent, okay, the kid has been playing with his electric trains now for 3 days running, and he's getting bored with them, right? And you've been listening to the same gift of that musical CD over and over. You've heard the music so many times now. It's boring. So what is impermanent is suffering. Okay, and this body, which we take as the basis for happiness, this is impermanent also. Probably the most important aspect of rupa. And so the body that we enjoy when it's young, strong, healthy, now it gets old, sick, subject to illnesses of different kinds, so was it really happiness or suffering when we were enjoying ourselves back in the days of our youth? Even then, because it was impermanent, it's suffering. Okay, so now the question comes, is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change? And here, the word that's translated as change, viparinama dhammas, subject to change, this word viparinama, it doesn't really mean change the way in the sense of the English word, just change of state, but viparinama has the implication of deterioration. So it should be really what is subject to deterioration. I think this would be your Chinese huai. Is this fit to be regarded thus? This is mine. This I am. This is myself. Okay, so this is particularly said with regard to the material form of one's own body. Does one want to say of this body, which is impermanent, always changing, deteriorating and subject to suffering. That this is mine, this I am, this is myself. And then the answer comes, no, Venerable Sir. And so, again, underlying the question and answer, there is a certain conception of what is fit to be regarded as oneself. And here would be something coming from the Indian background, conception of the self, but also I think there's not only an Indian conception of self, but also something deep within human nature of what we want to identify with and take to be our true I, what we really want to take to be I and mine. The Indian conception is the idea that the Atman, the Atta, the self, has to be something which is permanent, eternal, and by its own nature, blissful, a self-existing source of happiness. And so anything which doesn't measure up to those criteria, that of permanent existence, self-mastery, and being intrinsically blissful, is to be rejected as oneself. And then this, what I would call the psychological aspect of this, which doesn't involve Indian assumptions of the nature of the self, is just based upon reflection of what do we really want to take to be our self. I mean, in ordinary speech, ordinary discourse, we can use the words I and myself in relation to anything that happens within us. But when we think about what we really want to identify with, what we really want to take to be I and mine, and then we consider something impermanent, bound up with suffering, something that we can't control, that we don't have any mastery over, then at some level I think we would want to reject identification with that and turn away from it as being truly what I am, truly what is mine. Does that seem to be so? Is it? Or? If not, then say so. Okay, so the questionnaire first, it's worked out with regard to material form. Okay, so material form is shown to be impermanent. Because it's impermanent, it's dukkha. Dukkha means, we use the word suffering, but it means some way it's imperfect, unsatisfactory. Flawed is a good word. Not flawed in the way a boxer is flawed by his opponent. I mean flawed, F-L-A-W-E-D. Inadequate, defective. And because it's impermanent, and defective, subject to change, it's anatta, not mine, not I, not myself. Okay, then the same catechism or questionnaire is worked out with regard to feeling, perception, the mental formations, and consciousness. Each one, through question and answer format, is shown to be impermanent, defective, or suffering, and to be not mine, not I, not myself. Okay, so having worked out this, or demonstrated, or having applied the three characteristics to the five aggregates in the form of this questionnaire, now in paragraph 27, the Buddha is going to show the right way to contemplate the five aggregates with the use of proper wisdom, with sammapanya, with right wisdom. So he says, now he's drawing out the conclusion, therefore, O monks, any kind of material form whatsoever, whether past, future, or present, internal, that's pertaining to oneself, or external, that is, bodies of others or external physical objects, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all material form should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Then the same contemplation is applied to each of the other of the five aggregates. Any kind of feeling whatsoever, again, not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. Any kind of perception whatsoever, any kind of mental formations whatsoever, any kind of consciousness whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all consciousness should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And now there's a reason why this formula here uses these three terms, not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. These three terms are used, this is according to the commentaries, in order to counter, to negate what are called the three obsessions. The three obsessions of the ego, we might call them. How does it say in the book? This I am not, or I am not this?
This I am not.
This I am not. So contemplating the five aggregates as this is not mine, this counteracts the obsession or grip, the Pali word gaha, it's from the verb ganhati, to grasp. So it's the grasping or grip the grip of craving. So craving grips, grasps things with the idea, this is mine, or I want to make this mine. And so when one contemplates the five aggregates, this is not mine, then this sort of opens up and releases the grip of craving. Then conceit, the most fundamental conceit is the conceit I am. And so this conceit is based on the five aggregates. And on this basis one thinks, I am superior, I am equal, I am inferior. All of those ideas of I am sort of revolve around the five aggregates. And so when one contemplates the five aggregates, I am not this, that counteracts the grip or the obsession of conceit. So it relaxes this gripping of the five aggregates with the idea, I am this. And so then conceit, this mana, gets deflated, somewhat like a balloon that's blown up, the air gets released from it and it contracts. Then the idea of the different views of self are based upon the five aggregates, thinking this is myself. Myself is form, myself is feeling, myself is perception, I am the perceiver, I am the thinker, I am the knower, I am the doer. And so contemplating the five aggregates, this is not myself, this releases the grip of these different views that are based on the five aggregates. And so this threefold contemplation is the way to remove the three obsessions, the obsessions of craving, conceit, and views. Tanha, mana, ditti. Okay, so now the sequence goes from seeing the five aggregates as not self. This would be part of the knowledge and vision of things as they really are. That actually includes knowing and seeing the five aggregates in terms of all three characteristics: impermanence, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, and non-self. But eventually focusing on non-self. Then from there, in paragraph 28, one comes to disenchantment. This is nibbida, which means seeing through the five aggregates, the noble disciple loses this fascination with the five aggregates. Then through losing this fascination with the five aggregates, he becomes dispassionate towards them. That means the attachment, the deep attachment to them, breaks apart. And this is viraga, the ending of attachment or lust. Thus, not just in the sense of sexual desire, but in the sense of this deep holding or attachment to the five aggregates. And then through dispassion, the mind is liberated. That is, the mind is liberated from the asavas, the deep primordial influxes or taints of sensuality, the craving for existence, and ignorance. Okay, then when the mind is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated, and he understands birth is destroyed. The holy life, the spiritual life, has been lived. By birth is destroyed, it means that the round of rebirths has been destroyed, that there is no more possibility of any rebirth. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done, that is all of the work of practicing the path, has been done, and there is no more coming back to any further state of being. This is what is called the reviewing knowledge or retrospective knowledge, the knowledge which confirms after one gains liberation. This is the knowledge that confirms inwardly that one has indeed attained this liberation and that there's nothing more to be done. Okay, now in the series of passages, the Buddha here praises the monk who has reached the state of liberation using a number of, call these similes or images. Okay, he says in paragraph 30, this monk is called one whose shaft has been lifted. Actually, maybe crossbar has been lifted. What is meant here is a bar that blocks a door from opening, whose trench has been filled, whose pillar has been uprooted, one who has no bar, maybe better, one who has no bolt. There's no more bolt in the door. A noble one whose banner is lowered, whose burden is lowered, who is unfettered. Okay, then the Buddha explains in the following paragraphs the meaning of each of these analogies. The monk is one whose shaft has been lifted in that he has abandoned ignorance. He is one whose trench has been filled in that he has abandoned the round of births, that is samsara, which brings renewed being, punabhava. He's one whose pillar has been uprooted in that he has abandoned craving. He's one who has no bar or no bolt in that he has abandoned the five lower fetters, cut them off at the root, and so on. And he is a noble one whose banner is lowered, whose burden is lowered, who is unfettered, in that he has abandoned the conceit I am, cut it off at the root, and so on, so that it is no longer subject to future arising. Okay, then the Buddha makes a statement very difficult, quite difficult to understand. Paragraph 36. When the gods with Indra, the gods with Brahma, and the gods with Prajapati seek a monk who is thus liberated in mind, they do not find then you see the text is rather obscure here, so I had to add this. Anything of which they could say, then the text continues, the consciousness of a Tathagata is supported by this. The Pali says, evang vimuta chittang ko bhikkave bhikkhum sa inda deva sa brahmaka sa pajapati ka anvesang nadi gacchanti idang nisitang tathagatasa vinyananti. Okay, so they searching, they do not find. Then comes something in direct quotation marks. Searching, they do not find the consciousness of a Tathagata, which here could not mean, usually Tathagata means the Buddha, but here it couldn't mean the Buddha because it's speaking about a monk who's liberated. So it means any Arahant monk. And it's being used in the sense of one who has gone thus. So the consciousness of one gone thus, they do not find anything of which they could say the consciousness of one gone thus is supported by this, has this as its support. What is the reason for this? Then the Buddha says, even in this very life, I say that a Tathagata, or one gone thus, is untraceable, or cannot be tracked down. What the meaning of this is, the commentary tries to give some explanations, but you know, I looked at them and I didn't find them so satisfactory. Okay, according to the back note, it says the Arahant, even while alive, is here and now untraceable as a being or individual, because in the ultimate sense there is no being. But in that sense, one would have to say even any John Smith or Jane Jones is untraceable. But one couldn't say that. Okay, then it says the Arahant is untraceable here and now because it is impossible for the gods to find the support for his vipassana citta, his mind of insight, his magga citta, that's the mind of his path, the path consciousness, and the fruition consciousness. That is, the object is nibbana, and that mind cannot be known by the worldling. Maybe that is the better explanation, but still it's, I'm not completely sure whether that is correct. So I can't give a definite explanation what is the meaning of this statement. So we'll just move on to the next paragraph. Okay, now the Buddha deals with accusations that are made about him. He says that even though I say thus and proclaim thus, I have been baselessly, vainly, falsely, and wrongly misrepresented by some recluses and Brahmins thus, who say the recluse Gotama is one who leads astray. This is a play on words here. The word is vainayiko, which comes from the word vinaya, which has the sense of to guide, to lead, but it could also have the sense of leading away, leading astray. So this is the accusation that's made against him, that he teaches the annihilation, the destruction, the extermination of an existing being. Okay, now, you see, the Brahmins and other ascetics who didn't understand the significance of the Buddha's teaching of anatta, when they see that the Buddha is leading disciples to Nibbana, they think that he is teaching that there's some kind of permanent, some kind of lasting being, existing being, that is to be annihilated and destroyed. But, of course, the Buddha doesn't teach the existence of any kind of substantial being. So that's why the Buddha says that he is being misrepresented. And then he makes the important statement. Well, first he says that, as I am not, as I do not proclaim, so have I been baselessly, vainly, falsely and wrongly misrepresented by some recluses and Brahmins. Then he just repeats that accusation. And then he makes the important statement, which now has to be taken in its proper context. He says, both formerly and now, what I teach is just suffering and the cessation of suffering. Sometimes the statement is quoted, and what is said is that what the Buddha teaches is only suffering and the cessation of suffering. But actually, you see, the word chaiva here is used as part of a conjunction in Pali. It doesn't necessarily mean only. The Buddha teaches many, many other things besides dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. We find teachings of ethical codes for kings to follow. We find guidelines for husbands to treat their wives, wives to treat their husbands, teachings for children, how to treat their parents. So it's not the case that the Buddha teaches only suffering and the cessation of suffering. That would just limit the Buddha's teaching to two noble truths. But in this context, in relation to these accusations, what the Buddha is saying is that what he teaches is dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. So he's replying to these charges of annihilation, that he teaches annihilation, destruction, the extermination of an existing being. And he's saying that he doesn't teach this annihilation, destruction, extermination of an existing being. But what he teaches is dukkha, which here has the sense of, especially at the deep level, the five aggregates of clinging as being dukkha. And what he teaches is the cessation of dukkha, which is the liberation from the five aggregates of clinging, the cessation of the five aggregates of clinging. And here there's no living being that's annihilated, destroyed, or exterminated, but just this process, this beginningless process of the five aggregates that is brought to cessation. Okay, and now the Buddha is going to show his equanimity in the face of abuse. And you could say his equanimity in the face of abuse and reverence, veneration. So he says, when others abuse, revile, scold, and harass the Tathagata on account of that, the Tathagata on that account feels no annoyance, bitterness, or dejection of the heart. And if others honor, respect, revere, and venerate the Tathagata on account of that, the Tathagata on that account feels no delight, joy, or elation of the heart. If others honor, respect, revere, and veneration, and venerate the Tathagata for that, the Tathagata on that account thinks thus. They perform such services as these. So it's that which was earlier was fully understood. Okay, the sense of this, it seems a little obscure, but this is the way I would understand the sense of that. Okay, what was fully understood here is the Buddha is referring to himself as the compound of the five aggregates, which has been fully understood. He's fully understood his own situation as this compound of the five aggregates. And so when others are honoring, revering, and venerating him, he's just regarding this as services performed to these impermanent, selfless five aggregates. And then he gives the advice to the monks, if others revile, scold, and harass you, on that account you should not entertain any annoyance, bitterness, or dejection of the heart. And if others honor, respect, revere, and venerate you, on that account you should not entertain any delight, joy, or elation of the heart. If others honor, respect, revere, and venerate you, on that account you should think thus. They perform such services as these towards that which earlier was fully understood. Actually, it says they perform such services as these towards us. They perform such services as these towards us. Yeah, it's a little difficult, the Pali here. I'm not so satisfied with the translation. Okay, in regard to the Buddha, when he's speaking, he says, okay, such services are done towards me on account of that which was fully understood earlier. Then in regard to the monks, such, they should think, such services are done towards us on account of that which was fully understood earlier. So this advice, if it's interpreted the way I interpreted it, would seem to imply that the monks are already arahants, which doesn't make sense. Because fully understood implies fully understanding, the full understanding that's possessed by an arahant. And now the Buddha is giving the monks advice that implies that they're not yet arahants, that they still have to develop their insight further. I have to admit, the passage is a little unclear to me. I'll have to think about this passage a little bit further. I thought I had understood it, but now I see that there's a... Yeah.
Maybe it's not referring to the person of the Buddha or the monks, but it's referring to the teaching, the truth, so that, you know, if they're honoring, respecting, revering, if they're expressing positive feelings, you should think it's not to me that they're expressing it, but they're expressing it towards this truth which I'm teaching about anatta.
Because it's truth that was understood.
Right.
It could be that, yeah. But still, in the case of the monks, the word parinyatang, it's always used to refer to the full understanding that's possessed by an arhant in the sutras.
They would be relating it. They would be saying, this is what my teacher... They're saying, what does your teacher teach? And so, well, he teaches you should look for these three characteristics. Oh, that's wonderful. They're not saying it to you. They're saying it in regard to his teaching.
Okay, maybe that's a possible explanation. Okay, anyway, this is a point which is a little bit unclear. Okay, let us go on. Okay, then the Buddha again gives some new advice to the monks on how to contemplate. Again, we return to this theme of not self. And again, new method of contemplating not self. A new line of advice on the importance of contemplating things in the light of not self. Here the Buddha says, whatever is not yours, abandon it. Give it up. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Okay, what is it that is not yours? Okay, and this is going to be really radical advice, especially in a country where people are so much concerned with getting and getting, where the general tendency is whatever is not yours, get it and make it yours. Okay, material form is not yours. Abandon it. And what's meant by abandon it, here the commentary explains quite correctly. It means give up. It doesn't mean throw yourself down from a cliff to get rid of the bodily form. It means give up attachment and craving and clinging to it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Failing is not yours. So whether you're feeling pleasure pain, neutral feeling. Do not be attached to it. Do not cling to it. Feeling is not yours. Abandon it. That will be for your welfare and happiness for a long time. Perception is not yours. No matter what you're perceiving, pleasant things, disagreeable things, abandon that attachment to perception. Abandoning perception will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. The mental formations are not yours. Different volitions, plans, desires, all the different states of mind connected with will, execution, plans. Those are not yours. Abandon them. When you have abandoned them, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Okay, even the most innermost, the innermost source of awareness, of knowing, of consciousness, of being conscious, consciousness is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Then the Buddha gives this very memorable simile. He refers to this, he's speaking in Jeta's Grove, and he refers to there must have been different types of grass, sticks, broken off branches and leaves from the trees. And he points to them and he says, do you see these grass, sticks, branches and leaves? If people were to carry them off, to take them away and do with them what they liked, would you think people are carrying us off or burning us or doing what they like with us? Don't take that away. That's ours. Pay us for it. But they say, no, Venerable Sir, why is that? Because that is not ourself, nor what belongs to ourself. And then the Buddha says, in the same way, O monks, whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. And what is not yours, material form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Let me just try to finish the sutta. I could just go through it. Of course, we've actually come to these different groups of noble disciples already. They won't be new. So it's just a matter of running through them. Okay, now the Buddha ends the sutta with a kind of acclamation or declaration to show how this teaching is swakata, well proclaimed by him, to announce that within this teaching there are these noble disciples of the different grades, different classes. So he says, this Dhamma is well proclaimed by me, clear, open, evident, and free of patchwork. That is, it's not something which is put together, patched together, but it's something which is of a single texture, you could say, which is consistent, which is everything fits together as part of one harmonious whole. And in this Dhamma, well proclaimed by me, and so on, there is no future round for manifestation, that is, no future samsara. In the case of those monks who are arhants, who have destroyed the taints, That's the asavas who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached their own goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge. Okay, that is the highest grade of liberated disciple, the arhants. Then the next paragraph, the Buddha says again that the Dhamma is well proclaimed by me, and in this Dhamma well proclaimed by me, there are those monks who have abandoned the five lower fetters, and they are all due to reappear spontaneously. They are reborn without parents spontaneously, most in the pure abodes, and there they attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. Then the Dhamma well proclaimed by me thus is clear, free of patchwork. And in this Dhamma well proclaimed by me, there are monks who have abandoned three fetters and attenuated lust, hatred, and delusion. These are the once returners who return once to this world to make an end of suffering. Then, again in the Dhamma well proclaimed by me, there are monks who have abandoned the three fetters, those the fetters of view of self or identity view, the fetter of doubt, and the fetter of clinging to rules and observances. Okay, these disciples are stream enterers, no longer subject to perdition or rebirth in the lower realms, the three lower realms of the hells, the animal realm, and the realm of the afflicted spirits or ghosts. They are fixed in destiny, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment. Okay, the lowest grade of those who are the usual four classes of noble disciples are the stream enterers. But then in paragraph 46, we come to a class of monks who are said to be Dhamma followers or faith followers. The Pali for this, Dhammanusari and Sadhanusari. Okay, these are disciples who have you would say that they have transcended the level of ordinary persons or worldlings. They've entered into the fixed, what's called the fixed course of rightness, that they are bound to gain realization of the truth of the Dhamma, though they haven't yet gained realization. And they differ according to their dominant faculty. The faith follower is one for whom faith is the dominant faculty. The Dhamma follower is the one for whom panya, or wisdom, is the dominant faculty. Both have to achieve realization through wisdom. But you could say that for the faith follower, the motivation for practicing is their faith and conviction in the truth of the Dhamma. Whereas for the Dhamma follower, their motivation, their driving force, is this urge to understand and to fathom the truth. I think we'll come to this, we'll learn more about these classes of disciples in a later sutta. Okay, then in the final paragraph of the sutta, the Buddha says, this seems like a strong statement, the Dhamma well proclaimed by me thus is clear, open, evident, and free of patchwork. In the Dhamma well proclaimed by me thus, open, clear, open, evident, and free of patchwork. The way it reads in the text, the original text, Yesam mai sadda matang, pema matang, sabbe te saga parayana, which might have been translated, even those who have mere faith in me, mere love or devotion for me, are all headed for heaven. But this word mutta, it's a Chinese way, it seemed a little bit too much like a grand promise. So I used an interpretative translation that what he must have meant is that those who have sufficient faith, sufficient love, enough faith, enough love, are headed for heaven. Otherwise, somebody would think it's just enough to say, I have faith, I have love in the Buddha, I have love for the Buddha, so I'm bound for heaven. Okay, and so that is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Okay, now we covered quite a lot tonight. So if there's any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. Peter?
Consciousness is always, I don't know if you may have a vague term. The reason why consciousness would be considered impermanent is because, if I'm recalling correctly, because he's always specifically referring to a consciousness tied to a specific sense.
Yeah. Consciousness is all in Buddhism, it's always a specific type of consciousness arisen on the basis of a specific sense faculty, knowing, being aware of a particular object. So there's no such thing as in Buddhism as a continuous, unchanging consciousness. But consciousness is always arising based on conditions. I believe the next sutta that we're to deal with has more to say about consciousness.
Okay. Could we substitute the word knowing for consciousness?
I actually think the word consciousness is not so satisfactory for vijnana, and the word knowing has a certain advantage, though it seems to me that not every instance of vijnana would be really a clear case of knowing the way we use that word in English, that there would be many instances of vijnana in which there's not clear knowing. But consciousness in English, you see, it's difficult to make a verb out of the English word consciousness, right? But now, the Pali word vijnana easily, it's based on a verb, vijanati. And so the way one gets the word for consciousness, vijnana, is vijanati, vijanatiti, tasma vijnananti vuchati, which would be something like it. That's why we don't have the word it. Consciousnesses, it can't, it, what?
It is conscious of. cognizes?
Yeah, cognizes, that's what I've used, but cognizes is not the actual verb that goes with consciousness. Cognize goes with cognition. In fact, cognition might be the best translation for vijnana rather than consciousness, cognition.
So, whatever the verb would be, could we say that there can't be consciousness without an object of consciousness?
Exactly, one can't,
that's a fair statement.
Yeah, there cannot be consciousness without an object of consciousness.
Okay.
In earlier discussions, though, you talked about the mind stream, this underlying stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
This act of consciousness would emerge from.
Right. There is an underlying, let us say, okay, I'm using that expression, the underlying stream of consciousness. This is an idea, it's a post-canonical idea. It's not, or it's a post-Nikaya idea. It's not explicitly brought out, or it's not brought out very clearly in the Nikayas themselves. It comes in the Abhidhamma. It's called the Bhavanga, which means literally, they call it the factor of becoming, the factor of existence. So that is what I call the underlying stream of consciousness, the underlying mind stream. And this too, the way it's treated in the Abhidhamma, is made up of individual acts of consciousness. Now those acts of consciousness, we call them acts of consciousness, but they are not acts of consciousness that occur at the level of clear consciousness. You might call them acts of subconsciousness. So they are cittas, individual acts of consciousness, but they are not, we never know them clearly. Because they're always occurring either in deep sleep when there's no dreaming going on, then the bhavangas are occurring. They're occurring if one goes into a faint, they'll be occurring. And they're also occurring many, many times in the course of the day, even while you're sitting there, while I'm sitting here talking. Many, many times each second, our minds are going into the bhavanga and coming out, going in, coming out, somewhat like the way a computer screen is constantly blacking out and reconstituting itself, blacking out, reconstituting itself, maybe thousands of times a second, and yet we're looking at the computer screen and it seems to be a continuous image. We don't see it blacking out and reconstituting itself. And so our minds are always going into the bhavanga, coming out, going in, coming out. And the bhavanga has its own object. And that object, it's the same object for every bhavanga consciousness. And what is the object of that bhavanga consciousness? It is a particular object that presented itself to our consciousness in the death process of the previous life. So the bhavanga consciousness that's occurring many, many times each second, it constantly has before it that particular object, which was a particularly striking object from the previous life. So we're always getting reminded what was that significant event, that significant object from the previous life that sort of brought us into this life, but we can't find out what it is. Because it's always beneath the threshold of ordinary consciousness. Yes?
You mentioned that in the description of the Indian conception of the Atman, that you used the term self-mastery, and I wasn't sure exactly. I mean, I followed what you were talking about when you were talking about the psychological aspect,
yeah.
But I wasn't sure how. What the term self-mastery referred to specifically for the Indian conception.
Yeah, that the Atman, the self, should be something which is capable of doing whatever it wants to do and of controlling things so that they conform to whatever it commands, whatever it wishes, will occur according to its command.
Like ultimate control.
The kind of ultimate control, that's a good expression. That's why in the Buddha's second discourse, the discourse on not self, when he's using this, trying to demonstrate the truth of anatta to the monks, he says, are you able to have it, that's the expression, labeta, of form, or a feeling, perception, the mental formations, consciousness? Are you able to get your way with them so that you could have it? Let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. And then they say, no, we cannot get our way with these five aggregates in that way.
So it was a direct reaction to the previous concept.
Yeah.
In paragraph 46, the faith followers and the Dhamma followers,
yeah,
are they fixed in destination or are they just headed in?
One would say that they're fixed in destination, even though the Buddha doesn't yet say that they're niyato. But they cannot fall away. Once one becomes a Dhamma follower or a faith follower, one is bound to reach stream entry. One has to realize the fruit within that life. The Buddha says that one cannot die without having realized the fruit of stream entry. And so once they realize the fruit, then they become fixed in destiny.
For the other levels, there are particular criteria.
Yeah.
But what are the criteria for?
What do you mean?
The three lower fetters for a stream.
Yeah, yeah. What is eliminated by the faith follower or Dhamma follower? They don't eliminate, they haven't eliminated anything yet. But what they've done is they've gained enough understanding of the Dhamma so that they are bound to gain the actual realization or crowning insight into the Dhamma within that life itself. They've undergone, it's called entering the fixed, which means that they've entered upon the world transcending Noble Eightfold Path, the super mundane Noble Eightfold Path, but they haven't yet realized the fruit of the path. Okay, we've got to stop now. Okay, end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabumata Adeva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Mangparam Eta Vata Cha Amehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Deva Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Eta Vata Cha Amehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Bhuta Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Eta Vata Cha Amehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Satanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya.